This is Mark Strassman, reporter with Entertainment Technology World. We're about to speak to Walt Ordway, who's the Chief Technology Officer at DCI, which is the Digital Cinema Initiative. Welcome to Utopia Media's Entertainment Technology World.
Good afternoon, Mark.
Why don't you tell us first what DCI is and who some of the members of it are?
DCI is a company that was set up by the seven major Hollywood studios. Let's see, we have Sony, Fox, MGM, Paramount, Universal, Warner Brothers, and who did I miss? Disney.
Disney.
And they set up the LLC in the spring of the year 2002 with two primary goals. One goal was to take a look at possible economics and business rollout models of digital cinema.
Okay.
But the primary goal was to set up a specification to establish what they would hope would be a uniform format for digital movies to be delivered in. Again, it's a specification. It's not a standard.
What's the difference between a specification and a standard?
A specification is something that we write, and if you want to use it, fine.
Okay.
A standard is something that's published by like a SMPTE organization or
okay.
an ISO organization or a JPEG organization that publishes worldwide standards that
right.
people build things to.
Right.
So this is a specification. It simply says these seven studios feel that this is the format that digital movies ought to be delivered in.
Right.
And, oh, by the way, it's a volunteer format.
Right.
So if one or more of those studios said, you know, even though we've got it written, we think part of it or all of it's not right, they don't have to abide by it. It's totally, totally voluntary, and that's to avoid anything that has to do with antitrust.
Okay.
Okay.
But this is going to mean that interoperability will be possible.
Absolutely, and that's what's not possible today. The problem today is that the several companies who have, in fact, delivered products to screens to show digital movies,
right.
each one of these companies used in some area or the other their own format, or
right.
a format which is different than the other guy used. And this was to set up a common format so that, you know, like 35mm film, no matter what 35mm projector you use
right.
it in, the perfs are all in the same spot.
So right, exactly.
That's so, exactly what this is.
So this will mean the studios will be able to put it into that format, use standardizable equipment that meets the specs to transmit it, and then the theater owners will be able to use standardized equipment to project it, and then everybody can compete in those different areas, but they'll all be competing along the same specifications.
Yeah, let me just correct a little what you said there.
Okay.
It's academic how a post house or a studio gets it into the right format. They
right.
can do it any way they want as long as they get it into the right format.
Right.
And again, once it's in that format and arrives at the... It's academic how it gets to the theater.
Right.
Okay, satellite, fiber, or a physical media.
Right.
But once it gets to that theater, once it's in the storage device inside the system in the theater, yes, then the uniformity of the format means that any system can play it off.
Okay. Does the format have a name?
Not really.
Is it the DCI?
People are just referring right now as the DCI format. However, in the standards process of SMPTE, the Society of Motion Picture and Television Engineers,
right.
they have been working since January of 2000 to anticipate digital cinema coming.
Right.
And instead of waiting until someone built it and then writing a spec around it, they said, let's try to anticipate that and see if we can write a series of specifications for the various parts.
Right.
And so if you talk to SMPTE, they would call the post-production part of this thing the DCDM, the Digital Cinema Distribution Master.
Right.
Okay, that says, and that's what we have in our spec. That says I have a certain format for the image, I have a certain format for the audio, I have a certain format for subtitles, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
And then in the process, then, they do what we say in our spec. They compress it, encrypt it, and package it electronically, and then it's ready to go.
So what you're doing and what SMPTE is doing are complementary?
What we're doing is we wrote a specification. Now, SMPTE started their process before we came along.
Tell people outside the industry what SMPTE stands for.
The Society
right.
of Motion Picture
right.
and Television Engineers.
Okay.
S-M-P-T-E.
Okay.
Yeah. And again, what they did was, normally they will adopt the specification subsequent to a company putting something on the market. That's been the trend. What they wanted to do this time was anticipate that and create the standards to which people would manufacture prior to it.
Right.
Well, okay, it was academic where they were in their process. When we started DCI, the studio said, these are the formats we want to use, period.
Right.
Not all the ones that Simpty has picked.
Right.
These are the audio formats we want. These are this. Subsequently, what has happened is the Simpty folks,
right,
people who work on the standards, which are basically, by the way, individuals from various companies. Okay, they're all volunteer folks.
Okay.
But what they've been doing is they've now modified what they had done to be in line with the DCI specification.
Okay, so everything is working. So are they going to come up with standards rather than specifications?
Oh, no. They are working on standards. As a matter of fact, right now, if you look at if you had a table of what's in work, there are probably 24 standards. Now you say, well, wait a minute, why isn't there just one digital cinema standard?
Right.
Well, there's a standard for maybe the image. There's a standard for the audio. There's a standard for subtitles. There's a standard for the compression. There's a standard for the packaging.
Right.
Every little aspect of the, I'll call it the post-production process, has a standard or maybe 2 or 3 sub-standards that go into more detail. There are standards for some of the equipment in the theater.
Right.
And I won't go into detail, but obviously they don't have to standardize a server. I mean, a storage device. Storage is storage.
In other words, the functionality has to be there.
Of the unique things, like the one of the bigger issues in the theater is the use of the key that does the decryption.
Right.
There are several standards or recommended practices, as they call. Sometimes they're called standards and sometimes they're recommended practices.
Right.
There are several of these in work that just describe how this key is used, how the use of the key is logged, what kind of content is logged. I mean, it goes on and on. So
how do your specs relate to those standards?
Well, let me just wear a studio hat for 1 second.
Okay.
From the studio's point of view, the studio says, look, we've put DCI together to write a specification.
Right.
If the studios are then saying, by implication, we would like to deliver movies to that specification.
Right.
Now, again, it's voluntary.
Right. But it's voluntary.
So if Simpty, let me just give you the extreme case. If Simpty were to write a standard, totally contrary to the specification, now it's a question of, if I'm a manufacturer, am I going to bill my system to the DCI spec or to the Simpty standard?
Right.
And the answer is, I better check with the studio to see how he's going to deliver content.
Okay.
And if you believe it, the studio would like to tell you, at least they would publicly today, we intend to deliver content to the DCI spec, and we would hope that the standards being put together would reflect our spec.
Right.
Now, the issue with standards goes twofold. One is our specification is more of a requirements document. It doesn't go to the detailed design issues.
Right.
It goes more to it must do this, it must do this kind of a thing.
Right.
When you write some of the standards, you go down to a much, much more detail. So at some point, we say, okay, well, here's the color spectrum.
Right.
It's XYZ, not RGB, by the way.
Okay.
And we just say it's XYZ and it's 12 bits per channel.
Right.
Okay, fine. But there may be some unique ways you have to use that to not muck up the image.
Right.
Well, okay, fine. That will probably wind up in a standard that Simpty might have to help the manufacturers all wind up on a uniform platform. And I'm not saying that's a specific one. I'm just trying to give you a general idea.
Right.
But the requirements document that we have written, specification, is specific in some areas and general in other areas. There's certain things that we say for a fact. The resolution will be either this or this, period, over and out.
Right.
The bits will be 12 bits per color, period. There's other things that we say, well, the system should be able to do this or that. That's a manufacturer's choice.
Right.
But because they have choices, there might be some problems of interoperability because of those choices. That's where the Simpty standards will go down to a deeper level to quantify at least one point of view and say, you know, this is the way to do it. And so their standard complements what we do,
So when the studio or an independent producer produces something, they're going to want to voluntarily, they may want to voluntarily comply with the DCI specs as well as observing the SMPTE standards.
Here's what I think the ultimate answer to your question is this.
Right.
At some point, very near future here, people will start building equipment.
Right.
You would think that that equipment is going to be built in such a manner to handle the format that I would say the majority of the studios want to use.
Right.
That will probably become by default the format.
Right.
I mean, let's face it, if four or five major studios today,
right,
and I won't give you any names, but if four or five of the big guys just said, yeah, we've talked to three or four of the manufacturers, and boy, that's exactly the format, it's exactly like DCI's, except it's got one little quirk. And if they start building systems like that, that's how it'll be.
Right.
If it's exactly like the DCI spec, that's how it'll be. That means if I come along a year or two later and I'm an independent filmmaker or someone else, and
right,
I want to put a movie on your screen,
right,
I'd better have it in that format, right?
Right.
Yeah. It's like a TV program. Once someone said this is the format for TV,
right,
that's what gets played on your TV set. So it'll be like the DVD enterprise, you know, where back when a couple studios or whatever said this is the format, we're going to move out on it, and once it happened, that became the format. It'll be pretty much the same here. The hopes are that the companies that start building them do it to DCI spec, which you would hope would be also in compliance with the SMPTE standard.
Okay. Now, one company comes to mind that and as well as the concept of synergy, Sony produces films and they make audiovisual equipment.
Correct.
And presumably they're going to be out there pretty early with equipment that meets the specs that the DCI that they're a member of has established.
Correct.
Won't they?
And Sony has made it well known that they're going to be producing a complete system, which includes a projector.
Right.
Like other people. Other people are producing projectors and in the storage and other hardware,
right,
and putting together as a system.
Right.
Sony has stepped up and said, we're going to do the end-to-end,
right,
the entire system.
Right. Has anyone else said that you're going to do that?
Well, let's back up. To
okay.
answer that question properly, the biggest item in that equation is the projector.
Okay, we're gonna, maybe we should diverge in a little bit to get a clearer picture of what the technology itself is going to look like. I think we've talked about the specs and the standards and their interrelationship and so on. Let's say I'm at the studio and we produced a nice film, and what are we going to do to it? And we've got I may be a little behind the times here, an answer print. There's the stuff that would normally be reproduced and sent out to the studio, to the theaters, right?
Correct.
Okay, so that's there. Now, let's follow those images and sound from the vault over there at the studio to the people watching them in the theater. What's going to happen? Oh, and before we start that, has anything special been done anywhere in the production or post-production process to end up with that content that's different now, or will that all be done the same way as it's done now? Constantly evolving, of course, but the same way for this as it would have been done for a film that would be carried around.
Well, let me jump way ahead.
Okay.
And let's make the assumption that maybe we're 8 or 9 or 10 years ahead.
Okay.
And basically, the movie industry, I'm sorry, the exhibition industry is digital.
Okay.
Okay, let's make that assumption.
Pretty much only digital is what we're thinking of.
Yeah, primarily digital.
So it's 2012 or something, 2013.
Yeah, well, yeah,
2015.
Eight to ten years away. I want to just make sure we're out in the future somewhere.
Right, out in the future.
And the bulk of the theaters in this country, the screens, and there's about 36,000 screens plus or minus.
Right.
The bulk of the screens show digital.
Right.
Now, obviously, the theater is going to keep a 35-millimeter projector around in case somebody wants to come in with a film, but
right,
the bulk of them are digital.
Okay.
We're at that point.
Right.
Okay, let's go back. A creator or studio wants to make a movie.
Right.
The answer is, use any format you want, 16mm, 35mm, 70mm, or digital.
Right.
Or use CGI, computer-generated imagery.
Right. So shoot it with a Panavision camera with film in it, or do it with video, essentially, at any resolution
you can
get.
Either do it on film or do it digitally. We don't care. Do it on a computer.
Right.
Okay. The studios do that today.
Right.
Okay. No change.
Right.
Okay. The digital cinema world does not prescribe that you have to start the acquisition process digitally. It does not say that.
Right.
But here's what would happen in the future, primarily. the owner of the content, let's say a major studio,
right,
has several release points. One is to the theaters. One is to the airlines. One is rentals. One is DVD sales. One is to the television, pay-per-view.
Right, one is pay-per-view over the internet.
Okay, whatever.
Yeah.
The whole point is that today, in today's environment, and in the future environment, each of those formats has a master.
Right.
Now, in the case of the movie, there's a master to call a print, and I'm going to send it off to the theater somehow.
Right.
Okay, the DVD, there's a master in a studio for exactly the format that's used in the DVD.
Right.
There's a master that's used for the airline release, which they make copies of and send them to the various airlines.
Right.
Okay. In the future, the studios will say, here's the economics. We're going to create what's referred to in our specification as a digital source master, DSM.
Right.
The digital source master is a digital master that has all the pieces needed to create any of the individual release masters.
Right.
Okay?
Right.
So you never have to go back to the film again if that's how you started the world. So
right.
Once I've acquired the content, regardless of how I did it, once I've done my editing and my, I'll call it my post-production,
right,
however I wanted to do it,
right,
I would create a digital source master which meets or exceeds every metric that I need for every kind of release cycle I have.
Right.
Okay, let's talk about the one we're interested in. Digital cinema distribution,
right,
master.
Right.
I'm a studio. I have my DSM. I have dealing with a post house. I want this thing prepared now for distribution.
One back step here.
Yep.
With the digital source master, does the term MPEG-4 come into this at all, or is there
The digital source master is not compressed,
not
encrypted,
right,
not anything. It is the raw material of the final product. It is uncompressed image. It is all the audio and all the channels. It's all the subtitles. It's everything I need to make any of the release masters.
Right.
Okay? So we're going to get to the digital cinema distribution master. That's the one we're interested in.
Right.
If I'm a studio, I can hand my DSM, which is a digital set of files,
right,
to a post house and say, here, I want this. I want a DCDM out of this.
And in terms of media, this would be on a DVD disc, a DVD type disc, or
this,
what?
Oh, this won't even come close to fitting on a DVD disc.
Right. What will it fit on? Will it be on a hard drive in a server?
If there aren't hard drives today built that would take it, it would have to be multiple hard drives. This is terabytes and terabytes of data.
Okay.
Yeah, I can't even tell you. The file sizes are enormous.
Is somebody hard at work on figuring out where to put this digital source master?
Well, this is a problem for studios. Do you store it in a giant server?
Right.
See, right now you can store it. This is called your camera negative, isn't it?
Right.
Yeah. You store it in cans, right?
Right.
Yeah. Well, okay, so what you have here now is you have a massive digital file,
right,
that is in the terabytes.
Right.
Okay. And it might be stored on, 20 or 30 Blu-ray discs,
right,
or it might be stored on, 6 or 7 digital tapes.
Right.
That's a studio issue.
Right.
Okay.
But some massive means of storage will be used to different studios can do different things.
They want to store
the terabytes.
That is their master. That is their family jewels.
Right.
Now, they can keep it for as long as they want and say, if we ever have to go back, we'll...
Right.
Well, whatever. Anyway,
right.
So I give a copy of this to my favorite post house.
Which is essentially you giving access to the files on this storage area network.
I'm giving access to... I might deliver to them a set of digital tapes.
Oh, okay.
That comprises the DSM.
All right.
Okay, I could do that. I could...
You put it in a truck... Give it to a courier, take it across town.
You could.
Put it on digital tapes.
That's an option.
Or if you've got it on your server somewhere in Switzerland or South Africa, you could just give them the password and they could access it there, couldn't they?
Yeah, keep in mind it's... Now you're running up against the problems, okay?
Yeah.
So the question is, does a studio want to do part of this in-house?
Yes.
Okay,
right.
Because at this point, there's nothing about that DSM that's encrypted.
Right.
Okay, so you have a real problem now. This is the family jewels. This
right.
is like handling the answer print or the camera negative.
Right.
Okay, I've got to get this now in the hands of somebody who creates the master for digital cinema release.
Okay.
So what they're going to do is they'll look at this, and I say, okay, I'm the post house. Do you want a 2K or 4K master?
Okay. What's the difference between 2K and 4K?
Okay.
Master?
There's only two resolutions in the two image resolutions
right.
In the DCI spec.
Okay.
I consider them as a box or a window.
Right.
2048 horizontally by 1080.
Wait a minute. 2048 by
1080.
By 1080.
Okay. That's referred to as the 2K.
Right.
Or the second one is exactly double that. 4096.
Right.
By 2160.
Right.
Now, those are simply windows of pixels.
Right.
Regardless of the aspect ratio that you want to use for the movie, it must fit inside the window. So you're either going to go full left to right, but not top to bottom, or full top to bottom, but not left to right. Okay? Because what we're doing here is we're suggesting in our spec that we retain square pixels.
Right.
If you understand what square ones are versus
yeah.
rectangulars.
Right.
So all we have here is a box. Okay? In other words, the imaging device will be 2048 by 1080 or 4096 by 2160, and you use whatever aspect ratio within that box you want, either full width but not full height or full height but not full width. Okay.
Right.
So the only thing you have to tell me, Posthouse, is which of these formats do you want your basic movie to be in?
Right.
Because the DSM has to be able to do at least the 4096.
Right.
Okay? Now, the master could be even greater. It could be a 6K horizontal resolution. It could be a 10K, 12K, whatever the studio wants to say. I want to retain all the information that was in the original whatever.
Right.
Okay, so that's their choice, but that master will have to be at least 4096 by whatever.
Right.
Okay, if you say, I want a 2K, okay, fine. They'll down-res that to 2K by whatever the aspect ratio is.
Right.
It'll be at 12-bit because that's what the master is.
Right.
They will go into the audio. And they will decide, okay, there's a potential here of 8 channels of audio. What do you want in your movie? Well, maybe we want 8. Maybe we want to ship, 5.1 or 6 channels.
Right.
That's the decision the studio has to tell the Posthouse.
Right.
Subtitles. Do you want English, French, Spanish, Japanese? What do you want? Oh, let's see. We want this one, this one, this one, this one. We want 3 different versions. Okay, fine.
Right.
Okay, so I got 3 versions. I got a version with a bunch of subtitles.
Right.
Okay, the next part of the process. Now, the DSM is done.
Right.
I've finished with it.
Right.
Now I'm going to process the DCDM to create what's going to get shipped. Okay?
That's the Digital Cinema
The Digital Cinema Distribution Master.
Distribution master.
Opposed to the DVD Distribution
right.
Master, as opposed to the Airline Distribution Master.
Right.
From now on, we're only talking about the DCDM.
Right.
Okay?
And you've locked up the DSM again. And
well, see, that's the politics here. Do I ship it back to the post house?
Right.
I mean, to the studio? Or,
right.
Yes,
or do I send my own armed guard over there to watch over the people who are doing it every minute?
And, okay, well, right. all of the above is true.
Right, okay.
These are issues now you
right.
have with digital.
Right.
Okay, so the first part of the process now, in the post-production process, is to compress the image.
Ah, okay.
We're specifying not to compress the... the audio,
right.
which will not be compressed by somebody's specific corporate compression that has IP.
Right.
Not the case. This is going to be audio in zeros and ones.
Right.
Nothing proprietary about that.
Right.
Well, then there's the subtitles. Then there's other stuff called metadata. Okay, fine. But primarily the compression is the image.
Right.
Okay. Next part of the process. I now have... image compressed, it has to be compressed. I have the other components. I now need to encrypt.
Right.
I will encrypt the image for sure. But now this is a studio. This is a studio option. I'll compress the image for sure.
Right.
I have the option of compressing the audio.
Right. You mean encrypting?
Encrypting
the audio.
Yeah, encrypting right. the audio. And the reason is, let's say I'm putting out something where the music in the movie is going to be sold as musicals or something,
right.
as audio stuff.
Right.
Why would I want someone to download this file
right.
from some place and give them unencrypted audio?
Right, when the audio is central to the whole process.
When the audio might be important as a sale of audio.
Right.
Okay, so I will obviously encrypt the image.
Now,
I may encrypt the audio.
Right.
I probably don't have to encrypt the subtitles.
Right.
Or the metadata.
Right.
In the third part of the process now, I have everything ready to go, but I have to pack package this electronically.
Okay, before we talk about the packaging, let's talk a little bit more about the encryption.
Sure.
What kind of standards are being used?
Yeah, it's a global standard called AES.
Right.
And it's, the older one was called Triple DES,
right.
Triple DES. But the newer one, the global standard, is AES. It's very strong.
Bit lengths or
the,
what?
The key length. The maximum key length could be 256 bits. The key length for this is being prescribed at 128 bits.
Right.
Which should provide a pretty good challenge to people who want to break it.
Okay.
And the 128-bit AES today is generally considered to be quite strong.
All right.
So that's the encryption.
Right, okay.
And that's stated in our specification.
Right, and that would be used both for whatever's being encrypted, the image or the audio.
Absolutely correct.
Okay, so now it's
I have all these pieces that are compressed, encrypted, some compressed, some encrypted, but I have other pieces as well.
Right.
I need to electronically package them in a logical order that I can account for what I have.
Right.
And then later on, understand what I've got when it gets to the theater.
Right.
There's various packaging schemes that are used by, I'll call it, the post-production industry today.
Right.
The one that's going to be used, there is one used in television called Material Exchange Format, MXF. And it's very, very detailed, and what the community at large thought was, okay, that one's very good, it has a lot of features, but let's go and tailor the pieces we need specifically for digital cinema.
Okay.
And so the MXF packaging format is what has been put in our specification. The SMPTE people have picked up on that and run with it, and they have provided a great amount of detail as to exactly how it has to work, which is very good.
Okay.
Now, once I've got that, I now have, in the equivalent to today's environment, I have a large container with several rolls of film
that's
ready to be transported to a theater.
Right.
I now have that in the electronic world. And what we call that, compressed, encrypted, packaged DCDM, we call that the DCP, Digital Cinema Package.
Okay, so it's compressed, it's encrypted,
it's
packaged, and it's
it
a DCP.
It is ready to go.
Right.
Okay, now this is something I could probably get on a pretty good-sized hard drive today, okay?
Right.
Maybe many, many gigabyte hard drive, but there it is.
Right.
Okay, now this is the thing I need to distribute.
Right.
Okay, so it leaves the post house and goes to a distribution organization that I contract with if I'm a studio or I'm the content owner.
Can you give me the names of a few typical ones?
Well, let's decide how I get it there.
Okay.
There's three options. I can send something through a satellite.
Right.
I can send something through fiber, which we call terrestrial.
Right.
I could send something through physical media.
Right.
You know, like a disc or many, many discs, like a Blu-ray disc or maybe several dozen DVDs, because a single DVD is not even close to being a whole list, or maybe just digital tapes.
Right.
Okay? So I have three ways to get it there.
Satellite, physical, and fiber.
Satellite, physical, and fiber, yes. Okay?
Okay.
So if I'm the distribution organization at a studio or the content owner, I need to decide who do I want to contract with.
Right.
You know, and in the film world, am I contracting with Technicolor, Deluxe, whoever?
Right.
In this world, that's all physical. In this world, I need to decide, do I want to do physical content and then who?
Right.
And then right now it's not obvious who those people might be.
Right.
Or do I want to go to a company like a Quest or somebody and send it on fiber, or do I want to send it through satellite?
Right.
Now, each of those has an advantage and disadvantage.
What are the trade-offs, or what are the dimensions of those?
Ultimately, it's going to be cost.
Right.
Okay. But let's just pick satellite.
Okay.
I mean, if you have a satellite television, you know, dish or DirecTV.
Right.
It's pretty obvious that from one distribution point, I could hit every theater that conceivably would be contracted in this entire country.
Right.
On one shot.
Right. There are single satellites that have a footprint that cover all of North America.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
Oh, dozens of them.
All right.
Dozens.
And Europe and Africa and Asia?
Well, no, those are separate now. It's just
just North America. Okay.
I mean, every cable channel that comes to your local cable company,
right.
Every cable channel that comes to one of the satellite providers, Dish or DirecTV,
right.
Every one of those channels comes from someplace in this country through a satellite to the entire country. Why? Because they don't know where your local cable company's head in is.
Right.
Okay? So yes, most of the satellites in geosynchronous specifically been set up for, I'll call it the 48 states and whatever. Okay.
Right.
So if I can go to one of these companies and say, here, I'm going to give you my DCP, and on such and such a day, I want this simply sent out.
Right.
Okay, period. One-way transmission, done.
Right.
Okay. Here's the problem. That's the good side.
Right.
I can get to any theater in this country that I've contracted with blindly because the satellite's oblivious to that.
Right.
That's the good news. The downside is the bit rate that a typical transponder uses is a fraction of the average bit rate of these movies.
Right.
Even compressed.
Right.
And so a one-hour movie, which is obviously too short, on a 2K file might take 4 hours to transmit.
Right, four times its length.
Four times its length. On a 4K file, it might take five or six times.
Right.
Okay, so the issue is that a problem for a multiplex?
Right.
On a Tuesday, Wednesday, or Thursday prior to their opening days on Friday, if I've got a 24-plex, do I have the patience and time to be downloading, eight or nine or new movies that are all going to take 15 to 20 hours apiece?
Right, so you've got ubiquity, but the speed is slow.
Speed is slow. Now, when you go to speed slow, you're paying for satellite time by the second.
Right.
Okay. All right, so there's a plus and minus. I can get anywhere I want to get in one shot.
Right.
Speed slow. Fiber, high-speed fiber, not low-speed fiber. We're talking high-speed fiber that delivers probably in pretty much real time.
Right.
Who paid for the last mile into the theater?
Right.
It wasn't the studio. Had to be the exhibitor, didn't it?
Right.
Yep. Okay, so there's a good side and a downside there. Let's go back to the satellite operation.
Okay.
If I'm Studio A and I contract with an uplink company, they must put in the theater, on the roof of the theater, their dish, and they got to put in the theater, next to the system, the satellite receiver.
Right.
That's great. But you're another studio, and you don't want to contract with that satellite carrier. You want to contract with a different satellite group.
Right.
That satellite group also has to put a dish on the theater, because guess what? It's high probability that each of these companies uses different satellites at different places in the sky over the equator.
Right.
So what's going to wind up if there's more than one or two dishes is you're going to wind up with a roof of a theater that looks like a cable head-in.
Right.
Okay?
Yeah.
And it's going to have a rack of satellite receivers inside.
Right.
Okay, so the upside is distribution, the downside is too many competitors become problematic, possibly for exhibitors.
Right.
Now, I'm not trying to vote here. I'm just trying to give you both sides. Okay?
Sure. Right.
Okay, the fiber we talked about. Let's get to the physical distribution.
Right.
What format? Well, let's say there's three companies who are going to do physical distribution. One says I'm going to use DVDs are cheap, so I'll just use 50 DVDs for a movie.
Right.
Another guy says, I'm going to use Blu-rays because they have more capacity. I can get these movies on four DVDs or four Blu-rays.
Right.
Another guy says, you know what? We're going to use tapes.
Right.
Okay, that's fine. That's their call. It's not important to me, the studio, which format to use because it's academic. I got my DCP and I want to get it to the theater, and I don't care how they get it there as long as it's secured, right?
Right.
But everybody who has a mechanism for distribution, Blu-ray disc, they need to have in the theater a receiver for that.
Right.
Just like the satellite guy.
A player.
Yeah, hold on one second.
Yeah.
You guys going out? Okay. No. Leave me some water. No. So Studio A contracts with the guy who wants to use the Blu-ray disc.
Right.
Then every theater that studio ever intends to deliver to must have the Blu-ray device I can put the disc in at the theater and then plays it into my system.
Right.
If someone else wants to use nothing more than a DVD player that I have 50 discs to unload each time, then at the exhibition I have to have also that guy's DVD player. Now, the bill for this is on the guy who makes the distribution, not the exhibitor.
Right.
But the point is I will have a variety of devices that play the media that could possibly get sent to my theater.
Right.
Okay? So there's the pros. pros and cons. The pros are, in the final analysis, it'll be economics.
When it comes in on high-speed fiber,
yep.
All they need is a store.
Here's what happens. Yeah. Let me just go to the next point.
Okay.
The digital cinema system in the theater, from our specifications point of view, says there's an input to the system.
Right.
You can feed that input with one of three things. The output of the satellite receiver.
Right.
Fiber.
Right.
Or the output of a physical storage device.
Right.
Okay. You simply feed a port. You're now in the digital cinema system in the theater.
Okay.
The first place you're going is storage.
Right. There is so the digital cinema system, or DCS, which is what we're going to be talking about now, that we've crossed the threshold into the theater,
yeah.
Will get its feed from a satellite or a fiber or a physical.
Yeah. All we're doing is we've specified that the system that goes in the theater,
right,
has a common interface for,
right,
the outside world.
Right.
And you can feed that interface with the output of your satellite receiver, with your fiber feed, or with the output of your physical device reader.
Right.
Okay. But what you do is when that content comes to the theater, it immediately goes into the system,
right,
into storage.
Right. That's a component of the DCS,
yeah,
is the storage element.
Yeah,
storage,
if you want to call it DCS. Right. So it'd be like saying let's say I had cable or... let's say satellite television is the easiest analogy.
Right.
Like saying, I can receive my satellite television, but it's going to go into my my TiVo first before I get to see it.
Right.
It's going to be stored first. So
right.
So the first thing that happens with it is we're going to store it. Nothing gets played off from the storage device in the satellite receiver. Nothing gets played off from the Blu-ray disc or the DVDs.
Right.
Everything gets played off from storage in the system.
Got it.
So now I'm past transport, and I've got a compressed, encrypted, packaged file sitting in storage.
Right.
Okay. Somewhere during the course of a week, the week prior to typically, which is a Friday, which is when movies start, somewhere,
right,
in the course of the week, someone at that specific theater. Now keep in mind, if it came in by satellite, literally any theater could download that.
Right.
If it came in by fiber, it was probably directed to the right facility.
Right.
If it came in by physical media, it was more than likely given only to the right facility.
Right.
Okay? Okay. Academic of that, or independent of that, somewhere during the course of the week, the individual who establishes what screen things are going to be played on,
right,
will sit in front of his computer and say, okay, let's see, I've got a 10 auditorium complex here.
Right.
I'm going to program auditorium 1 for Friday. And this is maybe Wednesday afternoon or something.
Right.
So he goes to a folder that says pre-show ads, and he drags and drops some number of pre-show ads.
Right.
He goes to a folder that says trailers.
And we've been only talking about feature films here.
Well, okay, but
you were saying that ads and trailers are all going to be processed the same way.
No, different.
Oh, okay.
He will put our system does not talk about ads, and it does not talk about alternative content, okay?
Right.
It doesn't do that. It talks about primary movie content, which could also be a trailer.
Right.
But I'm not trying to just tell you how the operation in the theater happens.
Right.
Even though I'm going to add some other stuff in.
Okay.
Okay? But no, it'll get there a different way, blah, blah. So he will simply look at Auditorium 1. He will drag and drop from a folder some pre-show ads.
Right.
He will drag and drop some trailers, right? Previews of coming attractions.
Right.
And then he'll go say, okay, he'll go to a folder called Primary Content, and he'll drag the one title that belongs in that auditorium.
Right.
Okay. The screen is going to show him, okay, you've got yourself a 2-hour and 37-minute start to finish, therefore it might be reasonable to run this entire thing every 3 hours. He says, okay, fine. First show's at 1 o'clock, show's at 4 o'clock, next show's at 7 o'clock, and then 10 o'clock. Bingo.
Right.
That auditorium is programmed.
Right.
Okay, he will do that to each auditorium. See, so far nothing's happened to the file.
Right.
We're just setting up where it's going.
Right.
Now, let's go back and tell you one thing that we didn't tell you from the post-production house.
All right.
When I did the encryption, the post-production house, need something that's not mine that I don't have in my facility in order to encrypt that file. I need a piece of the key.
Right.
I get that from a third party that's on contract with the studio or the person who owns the content.
Right.
I contact them. I said, I am now encrypting movie XYZ from Studio A.
Right.
Feed me the key or the part of the key.
Right.
And a part of the key comes into that place. The encryption is done. Period. That's it.
Now, I don't want to get too fancy here. Is the transmission of that encryption key encrypted and so on?
It's a key. And how they get it to the post-production house, it's not the whole thing. It's only part of it. How they get it there is academic. It could be through any number of ways. But they get the piece they need.
Right.
Okay? Now.
Specific to that film.
Now, the piece they need is not going to decrypt it.
Right.
It only is going to encrypt it.
Right.
Okay, now the third party, by the way,
right,
they know that on a specific week, this movie is going to X number of facilities.
Right.
And they know what those facilities are because the content owner has told them.
Right.
Now, the real key that has the magic part in it,
right,
the real key, 128-bit, is now forwarded through some other mechanism to each of those theaters.
Right.
Okay? And it shows up through a different path, and it's in the system, and it's being stored.
Right.
In a thing called a security manager.
Right.
Another device.
Right.
Okay, so now I've programmed the screens. It's Friday. It's today I'm going to play off these movies. And what happens is the key does a series of tests. It says, okay, system, prove to me that you're the XYZ theater on 42nd Street.
Right.
It says, okay, here's my certification. Says,
these functions are being performed by the security manager component of the,
yes,
the system?
Yeah, this is what's called the key management system, or some people call it the digital rights management system.
Right.
This is all being done with the key, by the key, for the key, so to speak.
Right, and okay? it's essentially demanding from the theater owner or his or her representative the proof that they're who they were supposed to be.
No.
Okay.
No. The key trusts nobody.
Yes.
The key says, I must see something in the system that identifies I'm in the right place.
Right.
And not at Mark Strauss's house.
Strassman, yes, right.
Yeah, Strassman, sorry. Okay?
Right.
So there's an identification, there's got to be an identification in the system that says, in fact, I am this facility.
Right.
Okay, I got past that. Now the key says, oh, I'm about to be played here in a few minutes. I need to understand what day of what week this is, date.
Right.
Why? Because I know, I'm the key, I know exactly what days from and to, what's the window of play of this product.
Right.
And if you got me programmed for Thursday night,
yeah,
and my date says Friday,
yeah,
this key, I will not let this key work.
Right.
Okay? So the key goes through a number of exercises to make sure it's in the right place, on the right dates that have been contracted for by the two parties.
And in fact, it's going to go out somewhere to find out what the time and date is from the Naval Observatory or something.
What we're suggesting is, in the specification, is that they'd be accessed to right date and time. Not a clock that can be reset by someone who's playing with the system and wants to kludge it.
Right.
It's totally independent of that individual. Okay, and so it certifies that.
Right.
Now, okay, so I'm in Mark's house.
Right.
And I've somehow convinced the system I'm in a theater.
Right.
In the day and time are right. The next thing I want to know is the system I'm actually going to be played off on, not the system in the entire multiplex, but the system in the auditorium specifically that I'm being programmed for.
Right.
Has an authorized decryptor.
Right.
Okay. The thing that's going to decrypt me is in fact certified and has a certification number. Tell me what the number is, and I'll go check it against a standard database.
Right.
Okay.
So that means there's a decryptor in each for each auditorium.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Okay. So let's back up. There's the mechanics of the DRM system, but
right,
that's the basic mechanics. But now let me tell you what in some cases will happen, and we left this to the manufacturers. Okay. But I'll give you an optimum case, and
right,
again, it can be changed. When you bring content to a theater, you have two choices. If you knew where it was going to be played out, you could take it right to that auditorium and store it. But in 99% of the cases, when the content arrives Monday morning at whatever, Tuesday
right,
afternoon, you don't know where it's going yet.
Right.
Because you haven't programmed it yet. So it's suggested that there could be a thing called central storage, a massive storage unit that sits somewhere in the multiplex that holds all the content from all the screens for that entire week or
right.
and also the following week. Right?
Right.
The ones that are playing now and the ones that are playing
next week.
Right. Now, as soon as you program what's going where for Friday, the wisest thing that people could do, but this isn't necessarily what everybody's going to do, is a copy of that content gets moved down to an auditorium storage unit.
Right.
Okay? Now, it sits there waiting to be played out this Friday, but of course there's also one there being played out today.
Right.
Now, here's what you have from that point of view. Now, some people would say, look, it's easy. Let's just bring all the content into a central storage, and we'll play it out from there.
Right.
We'll run the wires right from central storage all the way down to the auditorium in question.
Right.
Okay, here's the downside of that. I have a failure to which people would say, oh, then we'll put backup RAID RAID displays into the storage device. I say, wait a minute, stop. Here's the problem. That room, you've got that central storage unit, the air conditioner just went out, and you lost every movie in the place.
Right, don't want to do that.
Right?
Yeah, you're out of
business. Every screen's dark, and that's the worst thing you can tell an exhibitor.
Right.
Every screen's dark.
Right.
So one of the advantages in having central storage and auditorium storage is if something happens in central storage, the show will go on because you have a copy at the auditorium. If something happens at the auditorium storage, you still have a copy back in central storage, which you can move to maybe another auditorium and still show the movie.
Right.
Okay.
Is there a worst case scenario in which
that's kind of worst case?
Well, when you've stored, you've got it in central, you've got a copy in the auditorium, and then something horrendous happens, and lightning strikes the building, and the surge protectors melt down, and it could all be obliterated.
Yeah, that's true. But the example I just gave you, we don't specify how the manufacturers are to do this. This is going to become a competitive advantage by showing the exhibitor how his material is being safeguarded in such a way that the show will go on. Anyway,
right.
So I think you get the picture. The picture is, in one scenario, there's central storage. I program the screens at some point in the week, either right then or later.
Right.
Copies of the content gets moved to the auditorium and sits there waiting to be played out. At the time of playout, the system then looks to the security manager that's managing the key and says, okay, answer the following questions or I don't play.
Right.
If he can answer all the questions satisfactorily, I'm in the right place, it's the right time, everything else, whatever the other questions might be, it's just bingo.
And it's going to have the separately distributed decryption key, right?
Oh, the key is there inside the security manager. It's inside a secure. The key is literally inside a device. Now, let me just give you an example. Let's say I got a pack of cigarettes.
Right.
I'm going to give that pack of cigarettes a new name.
Okay.
It's going to be called Media Block.
Is that B-L-O-C-K?
Yep.
Right.
Okay, let me tell you what's inside that media block. The compressed encrypted file comes into that block. Inside that file, the key is in there.
Right.
Inside the physical container. The
right.
key is in there. The key will do the decryption. The decompressor will do the decoding.
Right.
I now have clear text image.
Right.
Clear text audio with all the subtitles. Everything is there, ready to be pieced together.
Right.
What comes out of that block is the real stuff. Now, let's back up for a second. That container, by our specification, must be electronically and or physically tamper-proof.
Right.
Which means if you and I take a screwdriver and pop it open, that key says I've been tampered with, I will not unencrypt the file.
Right. This is what smart cards have had for a while in a lower level.
Well, yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So I've got a tamper-proof container because what potentially comes out of that block is clear text, image and audio and everything else.
Right.
Okay, here's the problem. Now that you know what a media block is, the next question is, tell me where physically the media block will physically be.
Right.
Now let me give you two possible answers. One possible answer is, it's in a storage device, which most people call a server.
Right.
The server sits over here in this corner of the room. Up behind the auditorium in the projection booth.
Right.
The projector sits in the other corner of the room.
Right.
I've got wire that's got to go 20 feet from the server to the projector.
Right.
It is not allowed in our spec that an unencrypted file can move on that wire. And so, inside the media block, yes, you can unencrypt everything. Yes, you can decompress everything. You can put the subtitling information on the image, blah, 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 all the rest of that. But if you want to leave that media block and be over in the corner of that room and going through a wire, you must re-encrypt now what is going to go to the projector, and that's called link encryption.
Okay.
So what travels through the wires is now ready to be put on the imager, the projector.
Right.
But it's been re-encrypted.
And with a different set of protocols and or keys.
Oh, yeah, right. And when it gets into the projector in the right physical place,
right,
it'll be de-encrypted.
Right.
So the link encryptor has a link encryptor at one end,
right,
and a link decryptor at the other end.
Right. Is it
now, if I use link encryption,
right,
remember prior to the show, the security manager said, tell me if the decryptor, the media block, was certified.
Right.
Remember that?
Yeah.
If it knows it's going to have to go through link encryption, it says, oh, by the way, tell me that the link decryptor is certified. In other words, any device which can decrypt this content must satisfy a set of questions to the security manager.
Right.
Okay. That's option one. Let me tell you what option two is. I've got a projector. And let's, as an example, whether it's the DLP or someone else, I've got an imaging device in there. Okay.
Right.
If you could tell me that you can take this media block, physically take the media block, and button it up, physically secure it to the imaging device somehow, so that, you know, my good friend can't go in there with a set of clip leads.
Right.
Okay? If you can tell me that there's physical security between the media block output, physical output, and the imaging device, no link encryption is required.
Right.
Ah, perfect. Now you've just reduced the cost of the system.
Is it at all allowed to use a wireless connection between the block and
the
imager? I imagine not, because people in the next room, unless it's lead-lined, will be able to listen in.
Yep. No consideration for wireless, at least not in our spec now. And
okay.
That'll be a long way. Anyway, so when the thing plays out, it gets de-encrypted, decompressed through those electronic devices or inside a physical container called a media block. The media block is either remoted away from the projector, which means I need to link encrypt it,
right?
Okay, or it's physically attached to the projection device,
right?
Which means I don't have to link encrypt it.
It's not recompressed. It's just,
No.
It's just re-encrypted.
Yes, correct.
Right.
So the bandwidth of what's on that wire, whether
right,
they're link encrypted or not,
right,
the bandwidth of there is high. Matter
right
of fact, on a 4K file,
right,
the instantaneous bandwidth is about 7.5 gigabits per second.
7.5?
Roughly.
7.5 gigabits per second.
Yes, roughly.
Right.
So it's serious bandwidth.
Right.
Serious bandwidth. Anyway, so now we got the image on the screen and...
Well, before we get it on the screen, we're getting it... So now we've followed it into the imager. What does this imager look like? I've been picturing this in my own mind as kind of a... The kind of audiovisual aid that used to put a piece... You put a piece of paper on it, and there'd be a light and a mirror, and it would send it up to the front of the room. Is that what's going to happen here? How does the imager work to get to convert the now de-encrypted, re-encrypted, de-encrypted again, decompressed 7.5 gigabit per second stream onto the screen of the auditorium?
It depends slightly on whose technology you're talking about.
Overhead projector was what I was
thinking.
Yeah,
the projector. So, I mean, we have... currently on the market are the DLP projectors.
Right. This stands for?
Digital light projection. It's a trademark that's used by the Texas Instrument people.
Right.
Who manufacture the chip. However, they license the chip to people like Christie, Barco, NEC, who produce the cinema projectors. Now, they also license the chip to people like InFocus or Panasonic and people who make just consumer projectors. They also license the chip to people who are putting them in rear projection TV sets. But
right,
there's a high-performance chip that they use for the cinema market that they've licensed to three manufacturers. So there's that technology. There's the technology that Sony is coming up with, the LCOS technology.
Because I was at a conference yesterday, and people had their laptops and a screen and a projector that was converting the
right.
what was in their computer. It's essentially that kind of technology.
That's exactly right. So if you I'll just pick the one technology, whether it's the digital mirror device, well, the digital light projectors.
Right.
The actual device inside is referred to as the DMD, the digital mirror device, because it works on the principle of little mirrors, okay?
Right.
Each pixel is a mirror.
Right.
But whether you have that or you have the LCOS or one of the other technologies, the issue is what's coming down this line now is information in three different colors.
Right.
Now, you would say red, green, blue. Unfortunately, in the case of the DCI spec, we don't use red, green, blue. We use what's called XYZ. These
right.
are the primary color space. Okay?
Right.
And it comes into the projector. But let's just talk about it as red, green, blue, because it makes more sense to the average person listening to this.
Right.
I have three colors. In the case of the high-performance projectors that do digital cinema, I have three chips.
Right.
One chip is a set of mirrors that's, 2,000 by 1,000, or it's either 2K wide or 4K wide.
Right.
One is going to be used for my red color, one's going to be used for my green, one's going to be used for my blue, if I had RGB, okay?
Right.
If I had it.
As it is, it'll be one for X, one for Y, one for
Z. Absolutely correct. Okay, now what'll happen is, and I'm going to make this simple, not complicated,
right.
is the red information, which is a whole ton of zeros and ones,
right.
by frame, is going to go down to one chip.
Right.
And it's going to go into the storage device in that chip and say, set all the mirrors, pixel for pixel,
right.
or mirror by mirror, but they're exactly the same now.
Right.
Set them all to exactly this.
Right.
Set each mirror, which is a pixel, to exactly a specific on-off rate. That's going to give me the specific shade by pixel of red on the next chip on the same pixel. The corresponding pixel will give me the corresponding color of blue I need, and on the green chip on that same pixel, it'll give me the corresponding color of red,
right.
green, blue.
Right.
So that, let's say we're talking about the upper left corner mirror.
Right.
The upper left corner pixel.
Right.
Okay. When the red, the green, and the blue light from each of these hit the screen, they average out to the exact color I want.
Right.
Okay. Now, how did I get to the screen? Well, first off, digitally, I got, I'll call it wires, one leading to each chip, to the memory on the back of the chip that says, here, I'm going to feed you the information for each pixel or each mirror separately. Okay, good, got it. The next thing I've got to do is I've got to put light on the face of this particular device, the DMD device. You put light on the mirrors and it reflects off.
Right.
I'm going to put green light on one, red light on one, and blue light on one. Okay?
Okay.
Now what I'm going to do is take the light that's reflected off of each of those chips, bring them through and average them out, bring them through a common focal point,
right.
through the lens and onto the screen. That's it. Now, whether I'm using the Sony 4K device, when you use three different devices, one for each color, the principle is the same. You feed digital information to each chip, literally to each of the pixel devices on each chip,
right.
saying, here's what I need for this one, or this one, or this one.
Right.
The colors get, the color of that, what that chip needs to be, typically gets either reflected on it or passive through it or something,
right.
and they get combined optically
right.
through prisms to go out through one common lens.
And the intensity of the light generated off of the pixels on the chip is sufficient to project through that lens and onto the screen.
Well, that's a whole different issue. Let's talk to that one.
Okay.
Okay.
Seems like it would need to be amplified somehow.
Oh, boy. What I have in a film is a light behind a shutter. I bring a frame of film down in front of a shutter.
Right.
I flip that shutter open. The light goes through and puts an image on the screen.
Right. So the light is behind the
in the film. It's the behind
image.
It.
And it goes through there, and
yeah.
it's now red light or blue light. Or
No. It's a xenon lamp.
Oh, okay.
And so
No. I meant the xenon lamp is pure white light.
Oh, yeah. Right.
And it goes through the film.
Film and whatever color
and whatever
the color's
there, that's what comes out the other end.
Absolutely correct.
Right.
Okay. Now the shutter closes. Right.
Right.
And it opens again.
Yeah.
And the same frame is shown again. Okay? Typically.
Right.
And then the shutter closes again.
Right.
And then the next frame is brought down in front of the shutter.
Yep.
So in a standard 35 millimeter, typically you see each frame twice. Even though it's 24 original frames, each frame is shown twice.
Oh. Okay. Right.
That's neither here nor there.
Right.
That's to keep the eye from getting too much flickering.
Okay? Right.
Okay. In the electronic one, there's something similar that happens, but it doesn't have to be that way. But the frames are, there's 24 frames, and they can refresh the frames any number of times before the next frame comes up, and that's again to keep the flickering out.
Right.
Now, if I have the mirror device, this is the easiest one for the audience here to understand. If I have the mirror device, what I'm going to do is, instead of having light behind this device, because it's a physical device,
right,
the light is in the front, off to the side, not in the focal plane, just off to the side a little.
Right.
I'm going to shine light on these mirrors, and it's going to bounce off and come back up through prisms and out through the lens. Okay.
Right.
Okay. I could either have three lamps, one for each of the chips, or one lamp that's broken into three light paths, and then with a color filter in front of it, okay?
Right.
Regardless of how I do it, the collective amount of light that goes from those lamps onto those mirrors and makes it out the prisms, out the lenses, and hits the screen has to be enough to properly illuminate the screen.
Right.
What does that mean? What that means is that in the SMPTE process, Society of Motion Picture and Television Engineers, in the motion picture side, for years now, SMPTE has prescribed how much light needs to be on the screen of a movie theater.
Right.
Okay. Now, they don't say whether it's 30 feet or 40 feet. What they do is they say, if you take a square centimeter on the screen, there has to be so much light there.
Right.
And they define that.
Right.
Okay. Let me give you some basic answers, though. These projectors are typically rated in lumens, L-U-M-E-N-S.
Right.
Okay?
Right.
If I have a projector which can put out 5,000 lumens,
right,
I can properly, according to the SMPTE specifications, illuminate a screen which is a little over 20 feet wide.
Right.
Okay? Plus or minus, I don't know the exact math here.
Right.
If I want to illuminate a screen which is, matter of fact, it's over 20, I think more like 25. If I want to illuminate a screen that's closer to 40 feet wide,
right,
I need 10,000 lumens.
Okay.
Okay? Because obviously, as you increase the screen,
right,
okay, whatever.
This is essentially the energy of the light that leaves
correct
the projector.
Correct. So in a film theater, if I have a bulb, it's the same issue with the bulb. If I have a bulb in a film projector that's going to do a small screen, I can cut the light output down.
Right.
But I have to have enough if I don't do a big screen. Same thing in the digital projector, okay? So the issue is, just because I got a projector doesn't mean I can properly light up a screen.
Right.
So, in the U.S., approximately, roughly, not exactly, but let's say 70 to 75% of the screens are 40 feet wide or less.
Right, 70 to 75%, 40 feet or less.
Roughly.
Right.
These numbers
less
are roughly. Okay?
Right.
Now, so with a 10,000 lumen projector, I could adequately light those screens up according to the SMPTE standards.
Right.
Okay? What are the premier screens in the country? You go to a premier theater.
Right.
How big is that screen?
I don't know.
Ah, bigger than 40 feet.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sitting here next to the Al Capitan Theater.
Right.
That screen is clearly bigger than 40 feet.
Right.
Across the street is the Mann's Theater.
Right.
Clearly bigger than 40 feet. We're talking 50 to 60 feet wide.
Okay.
Okay? So is the area, let's say I could double the area on the screen, not the width, just the area.
Right.
Then to get the same standard for SMPTE, I need to double the light.
Right.
Okay? If I double the width, I have four times the area. So if I went from a 30-foot screen to a 60-foot screen, I might have to have upwards of 20 to 25,000 lumens.
All right.
Okay? So why am I telling you all this? If I'm trying to get into the premier markets,
right,
in different venues, the premier markets.
Right.
And that, you say, well, I've got a multiplex now.
Right.
Well, I've got a multiplex. Even the Mann's Theater has multiple screens.
Right.
But the premier screen is the 55 or 60 foot screen.
Right.
That's the one where I'm going to do opening day for a big gig.
Right.
That's the one where I have to have a high light output projector.
Right.
Okay. So one of the competing issues in the projection world today is, and there's validity in both of these. One of them is, well, 4K projectors versus 2K. And there's some validity when 4K is is needed versus two.
Right.
Okay, not going to argue that.
Right.
The next issue is, if I want to get on the premier screens, I better have enough light output.
Right.
So the issue is that projector manufacturers are struggling to put out enough light to get on the major screens, because anybody can put out enough light to get on the small screens. We need to let enough light to go on the big screens. Because if I'm going to be Disney, Universal, one of the major studios, Warner Brothers, I want to make sure that I can get on that premier screen in the auditorium that seats a lot of people on that first weekend. And if you don't have enough light, I'm hurting on your digital projector. So what you're going to see in the digital world is the folks shooting for more light output to get on the premier screens, because that's what's needed.
Okay.
Okay. The other thing is they'll do is all the projector manufacturers are achieving a higher contrast ratio.
Okay.
Because to the average eye, if I ask you which image has a better resolution,
right?
Okay, I can actually get your eye. Well, your eye will think, if I have two images and one is slightly less resolution, but it has more contrast.
Right.
The human brain thinks that that's the one with the higher resolution.
So you can substitute better, higher contrast for more resolution.
So one of the things you want to do is enhance the contrast to give audience a better quality picture.
Right.
So it's not, what I'm saying here is it's not all about resolution. It's about resolution, yes. It's about contrast ratio, yes. And you put them both together, you get it all. Okay.
Can that dimension be manipulated at the screen level, or can anything be? If your audience likes a somber hues, can things be tuned down or anything?
Yes
like
and
that?
No. One of the things that messes up contrast ratio is the amount of ambient light in the auditorium.
Right.
Yeah, that's sad, but that's how that works. So typically, when these measurements are made, and the projector manufacturers brag about or whatever the contrast ratio, it's done in a perfectly dark room where
right.
the light is either on or off and they can get a perfect measurement.
Right.
The reality, though, is once you get into a practical auditorium with a lot of exit lights and walls that aren't, in some of the older theaters, the walls were a brighter color. Now they're typically dark curtained or whatever.
Right.
These can all affect the visual, what the eye thinks is the contrast ratio. But no, enhanced contrast ratio does a lot of good things for the apparent resolution of the image.
Right. Okay. It sounds like we've gotten the photons onto the screen and
yeah,
where they bounce off. You need a different or better screen?
People are going to use the same screens.
Okay.
Okay.
The colored photon is a colored photon.
Yeah. Right now, people are the exhibitor's not going to go and change his screen. He's going to use what he's got.
Right.
There are some interesting things. I mean, there are screens that are uniform gain of one, which means if you put so much light on, you technically get the same light off.
Right.
There are other screens that have gain, 1.5 or 2 or whatever.
Right.
If there's games that can be played there, and one of the games that can be played is if I have a screen with gain, I can put on your eye the right amount of light
right.
with less lamp light in my projector.
Right.
Yeah. Or I can turn my power down on my lamp. And,
right.
And of course, the less I can run my projector light at, the longer the life of the projector lamp.
Right.
Okay?
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Before we go on to some other subjects, is there anything else in the process that has been left unsaid that you think is important? Or about the process in general and how it's structured and plays out in the actual process itself?
I think we've covered the major topics, and
okay.
I think that that's generally it. We've covered the digital source master that the studio has,
right.
eventually conversion of or acquisition of the pieces of that to make up the digital cinema distribution master,
right.
the packaging, compressing, encrypting to make up the digital cinema package, and then the storing and processing of it in the theater in conjunction with the digital rights management use of the key.
Okay.
So I think we've covered the pieces.
Okay, good. No, we're not going to go into the other places where the digital source master can go, but could you just list them again and say that how the studios are going to essentially produce that digital source master and then use that to produce all of their other distribution modes?
Well, if I'm a studio, I could decide that I'm a 4K studio.
Right.
And so my digital source master will always have to be at least 4K.
Right.
Okay. I can decide of all the various distribution masters I have, I'm going to keep all the audio that I start with, if I start with 8 channels of audio or 6 channels, because each one of those will require either that or something less.
Right.
And, of course, when I have certain release masters, like the one in the airlines,
right.
I mean, there's several masters, right?
Right.
I mean, and these are the release points for film.
Right.
Right? First release point is the movie theater.
Right.
Second one's what? It's, I think it's yeah, hotels in the airlines. I'm not sure if it's hotels, but it's the airlines, I think, for sure.
Right.
Then it's, what, pay-per-view? Or it's not pay-per-view. It's rentals.
Right.
And then pay-per-view, I believe. I'm not sure exactly how these work.
Right.
Then there's the actual, I'll call it the video release, the DVD sales.
Right.
There's a copy that goes to a pay-per-view. That copy might be different that goes to a satellite company than the version that goes technically to a cable head in. I'm not sure if
okay.
they use the same format.
Right.
All of these other formats, though, are substantially less complicated
right.
than the digital cinema source master.
That's the top of the food chain. That's
yeah,
the most
that's the top of the chain. I mean, no one in their right mind for a television thing needs, well, first off, television doesn't take 12 bits of color per color channel.
Right.
It doesn't take XYZ color.
Right.
It doesn't take a 4K or 2K horizontal resolution.
Right. Now,
so what someone will do when they go to create these other ones, they will go to the digital source master, and I'll say down resolve to the what this one has to be.
Right.
You know, change the color spectrum to be in tune with television or
right.
what the DVD spectrum is.
Right.
And
that would also go all the way down. Yesterday, I was at UCLA learning about the future of cellular or cell casting of the VCast from Verizon and these systems that
right.
are going to put video onto cell phones. Presumably, then there'd be a master for VCast.
Well, if they're going to put a movie on there, then somehow the studio's got to give them either something that they will then, the phone company, makes something that's appropriate for their phone system,
right.
or the studio has to give them precisely what's going to go on their phone system, nothing more, nothing less.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. What's this going to cost the studios to, one studio, all the studios, to build and purchase all of these, all the equipment that they're going to need? And what about for the exhibitors? How much are multiplex theater owners going to have to spend to get
well,
up to speed on all this?
What equipment do the studios need?
Right.
Tell me what they need.
Oh, they don't. Actually, they just, you're right, they just turn the print out and give it to the
They're going
right.
to go to a post house.
Right.
If you took a movie today, take, I don't know, some percentage of the movies today.
Right.
And ask yourself, what percentage of this entire film that I saw on film,
right.
what percentage of that has been, in the post-production process, converted to digital for digital editing?
Right.
And the answer is, most films today have a pretty good portion of them, various scenes, converted to digital for digital post-editing.
Right.
Right?
Yes.
So think about that. That conversion has been done once, but then it was laid back onto film.
Right.
Okay, now let's go from there to the future.
Okay.
I've got the, I know what scenes I want. Well, let me start over. I know generally what scenes I want that are going to make up the movie.
Right.
I'm going to go to post and digitize them right now. I'm going to do the transfer right now.
Right.
Okay, 100% of the movie. I'm going to do my post-production editing digitally.
Right.
Guess what? I'm not going to lay it back on film.
No, why bother?
Okay, now, I could lay it back on film for one good reason.
Right.
Here's the reason. 50 years from now, it's a high probability I'd have no problem playing off the film as a master.
You mean the...
50 years from now, there's a good probability that if I have a digital source master today, the format for digital files 50 years from now is totally different than what I got today.
Right.
And this has already been experienced by a number of companies who started to digitally archive their movies. I won't tell you which ones.
Okay.
Okay? And what they found was, 20 years later, the devices which played off their digital files were no longer supported by the manufacturers of those devices.
Right.
You got it?
Yeah.
Got it. Okay. So, yes, I could have a digital source master for everything I want to do for the next year and a half or 2 years of my releases, but if I said, you know what, I want to archive something that I know 100 years from now I would have no problem playing off.
Right.
Guess what? It might be the 35 millimeter piece of film, isn't it?
So for that reason, yes. So for that reason, people are going to lay the digital back onto film in
most
cases?
Well, I'm just saying, all I'm suggesting here is this. If I'm a studio, I have a choice. I can consider my long-term archiving as a quality film taken back off the digital.
Right.
And I can, or I consider my long-term archiving as be my digital source master.
Right.
Or I can consider it to be somewhat both. I'll have the digital source master for everything I need to do for all my releases for the next year and a half,
right,
2 years, whatever, you name it. But if someone says, okay, 25 years from now, how do we go out and show this thing digitally? And the easiest answer might be, take the film,
right,
scan it in then-day scanning processes and
right,
machines, and play it off.
Okay. On sort of the converse of that, it would be possible now to digitize all the film going back to the turn of the 19th to the 20th century.
There are studios,
yeah,
and I'll give you one name, Warner Brothers,
right,
has got set up a very, very nice facility, I believe, over in Burbank area,
right,
where they are going into a digital archiving. So they're doing digital restoration. So what they're, and I'm only going to give you a generality, they,
right,
they go and they'll digitally scan a, let's say, an old classic movie.
Right.
They'll do some digital restoration.
Right.
So had there been some scratches in the images or whatever on the film, they
right,
can actually fix that digitally.
Right.
And then they'll do an archive of that. Now,
you mean back onto film?
I don't know if they're going back on film. I haven't,
right,
but I do know that they're doing digital restoration,
right,
of some of their older films.
Right.
Now again, I don't know whether they're only archiving back to digital or also back,
okay,
to film. I'm not sure which.
Right.
You may want to ask them.
Yeah,
again,
I think
I'm not
that's,
sure.
That's another
but
show.
It's very interesting what they're doing, and the quality of what they're doing. I've seen a couple of them, and it's very, very good. And I think if people could see some of the older films that were made that started to deteriorate because we didn't know how to store things right, et
right,
cetera, et cetera, they're solving that problem with the digital
right,
restoration.
So they can, in fact, take the films that are in not such good shape, scan them, digitally enhance or restore them, put them back onto film,
because
or use the digital source master,
correct,
which can then be used for everything from the big theater down to the cell phone and everything
it,
in between.
Yeah. Yep.
Okay.
At one point in time, you know, when we first digitized things back many years ago,
right,
going in and doing the, call it the restoration,
right,
is more difficult. But today, doing the digital restoration has become more commonplace.
And more automated and easier to do with faster,
yeah,
processors,
yeah,
and so on.
Now, if I'm a studio like Warner Brothers that has that capability, then it might be fair game to say that they would see the 4K file as a digital source master for
right,
future product.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
Okay. What's the cost going to be for multiplex operators to buy all the stuff they're going to need to do
see,
this?
That's a different issue.
Okay.
Let me give you some general answers there.
Right.
In years past, 10 years ago, okay?
Right.
The general concept was that it's obvious that the thing that's being replaced in the theater is the imaging device,
right,
the projector, not the audio system.
The speakers and the amplifiers.
Right, we're not changing that, right?
Right.
Changing them. The imaging device today costs, what, $20,000, $25,000, $30,000?
$20,000, $25,000, $30,000.
I mean, I don't know exactly what the price of
right,
a 35-millimeter projector is, but my guess is $25,000 to $30,000.
Okay.
Okay? Generally speaking. The thing that's replacing it, you'd be lucky if you could get a system for that auditorium for under $60,000.
For the imaging system?
Yeah.
$60,000.
The system we just talked about.
Right.
Right? You'd be lucky to get it for $60,000.
Right. And that's required for each auditorium.
Auditorium.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. Now, it's even more likely that the costs are higher, and again, it depends on the manufacturer,
right,
depends on what his production quantities will be and how
right,
he can amortize his cost, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
Okay. So, if I'm an exhibitor, replacing my extremely reliable,
right,
okay,
the
thing I grease and oil and change the bulb in once in a while,
right,
piece of mechanical device, changing that with something that's two or three times as expensive,
right,
and doesn't have the longevity of the mechanical monster,
right,
that creates a problem for me.
Right.
Okay, so the original problem, way back when this was first discussed, became very apparent that the exhibitor was the wrong guy to buy this.
Right.
Well, who should buy it?
Right.
Well, back then, 10 years ago, the answer was the guy who's saving the money.
Right.
Well, the guy who's saving the money is the studio.
Right.
Okay, that was a novel idea. However, if a bunch of studios got together and said, we're going to equip all the AMC theaters and Regal theaters and all the other guys out there, right, the Lowe's theaters, it would be kind of an antitrust thing because now the studios own the equipment that's in the cinema.
Yes.
And if I'm a cinema operator, that's very undesirable.
Right.
If it's my theater, I'll own the equipment.
Right, because so, they could say, you got my projector, you better run my films.
Yes. So the issue did not get addressed for many years.
Okay.
Here's the general current scheme of things today.
Right.
Okay? And I'm going to give this a general name. I'm going to call it the pay-as-you-go basis or the toll road basis.
Okay.
Okay? Mark, you're a bank.
Right.
You have money you'd like to invest and get an investment back.
Right.
Okay? I'm an exhibitor. Here's how the business model generally works. Not specifically now, very generally, okay?
Right.
I can go to the bank and borrow money from you to buy a system.
Right.
But there's conditions on the business model. Let me give you a couple conditions. One is, once I buy this system, I need to get paid, I need to get somehow reimbursed so I can pay off my loan.
Right.
Okay. Well, guess what? If someone comes to me with a movie to show digitally, and they can show it in my theater digitally,
right,
or on film, right?
Right.
If they want to put a print in my theater, what did it cost them?
Give me a rough estimate.
Roughly, $1,500 plus or minus. Just pick an average number, $1,500.
For to make it, to ship it, to,
yep,
watch out,
well,
out for
least,
it?
Well, at least the copy cost, yeah, and maybe including the shipping. But
okay,
if I want to put a film in a theater, again, it depends. The cost is really per minute of the film,
right,
and that's per footage of the reel. But,
right,
but let's pick an average number just so we can make a case here.
Right.
Let's say it's $1,500. I want to put a film in your theater on Friday, day and date. I got to pay $1,500 for that film.
Is that for one day or for the run?
No. That's what it's going to cost me to go to a Technicolor or a Deluxe or whoever makes print copies.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, I'm going to pay them.
But right. But that amortizes over a week. It's $1,500 if,
well,
it's
okay,
run for a day or for a week.
Okay. Yeah. Granted. But the point is, to get it to your theater, I paid $1,500.
Right.
That bill's paid.
Got it.
Okay. I don't care how long I play it there. I paid the bill.
Right.
If you want to put a digital on my digital screen,
right,
here's my deal. I'll let you put it on here, but you owe me money.
Hmm.
So you had a digital copy, didn't you?
Right.
Now you owe me, the owner of the equipment, in this case the exhibitor, if it's him, you owe me money. How much do you owe me? Less than it would cost you to make a print.
Yeah.
Oh, so you pick a number, $1,300.
Right.
Let's just say, I don't care what, let's say it's $200 or $300 less than the print copy.
Right.
Okay. Here's how the business model tends to work. Okay?
Right.
I buy a system from a loaner under certain conditions. One of the conditions is there's a basic understanding or agreement, fairly formal, that a specific number of studios will provide me digital content for at least some number of years to guarantee that that digital screen does not go dark.
Right.
Okay, what that means then is this. Given the average length of time a movie stays on the screen, that means that at some regular interval, 2 weeks or 3 weeks or 2 weeks or 3 weeks, someone's coming to me and paying me, what, $1,200 to put a movie on here.
Right.
Right. Set of numbers, that set of metrics, is enough that I can take that $1,200, if that's the number,
right,
and pay it back to you, the guy that loaned me my money. That's how you get paid back.
Right.
I'm just the middleman. Okay? What you want, you're the loaner now.
Right. Right?
What you want to make sure is, before you give me the money, is that in fact there's an agreement that a specific number of high-end studios have agreed to provide me digital content so that when they pay me, I pay you.
Right.
Okay, now, depending on the price of the system, the less expensive the system was, the faster your loan, my loan to you, gets paid off.
Yes.
Great. Okay, now, once I own the system and it's paid off at some number of years,
right,
guess what? Technically, I'm back to what we are today. Exhibitor does not charge distribution to put a movie in their house.
Right.
Technically, I could do that. Or I could say, you know what? these systems have a certain maintenance cost, and I need to charge you, $50 an event.
Right.
Okay, that's different. Now, is the agreement only for those three or four studios? Negative. I need the agreement with those studios because you said you want to make sure my screen doesn't go dark.
Right.
But if next week, after I get this system in, somebody else wants to put a digital movie here, I say, oh, your price is $1,200.
Right.
Oh, by the way, and send me the check or send it straight to Mark.
Right.
Okay, that's the general philosophy. So it's a pay-as-you-go thing with a guarantee of I'll say, usage of the screen. Okay?
Who pays that $1,500 now, the studios?
Yeah, they pay it to whoever makes the copies of the prints.
Okay, and then they deliver it, so then there's no cost to the exhibitor.
If I'm a studio and I say, look, I need 3,000 prints for a day-and-date release.
Right.
Okay, I'm going to go to one of the copying houses,
right.
Technicolor Deluxe.
Right.
If the number that you and I just used was correct, $1,500 for that specific studio at that specific year and month,
right.
Oh, then that's $4.5 million.
Right.
Bingo.
So in fact, the money that I'm saving as a studio, the $1,500 a month, I'm now going to pay, say, $1,500 per film, per studio, per theater. I'm going to pay that money directly to the exhibitor, who's going to essentially pay it back to the bank.
That's how the business model works.
Right.
Now, if the exhibitor doesn't want to pay off his loan, shame on him.
Right.
Obviously, he's not going to do that. So the point is this, that on day one of the rollout, whatever that means,
right.
When the transition starts,
right.
No studio is making a lot of money. I mean, $200 out of $4.5 million for my example is,
right.
is nothing.
Right.
And, you know, when 100 theaters are modified, it's still nothing. When you know, 500 are modified,
Right.
But as we start to get up to a pretty good number of screens,
you said there were 36,000
roughly
theaters or screens.
Screens
in North America.
But,
okay.
But if you open a pretty good sized movie, will open on 3,000 screens plus.
Right.
Okay. If you tell me that you've done a upgrade of, let's say, 40 or 50% of the screens in this country,
right.
then there's an extremely high probability that instead of making 3,000 prints for day and date right then,
right.
I might only have to make, 500.
Right.
Now my saving gets to be better each year, doesn't it?
Right.
Okay? And then finally, when you've paid off your loan, guess what? I, as a studio, can start to realize the ultimate saving.
Because you don't have to pay the $1,200 anymore.
Well, because now it's going to come down. Technically, that's correct, but it may come down to some other agreement that I have with the specific exhibitor, like I'll give you some fee that covers something else. Those are things to be covered, but technically, you're right. Technically, that cost went away.
Right, and okay. Presumably the studios can, that's a basic expense that they can, that they'll get whatever tax benefits they get from their expenses. Right?
Either the money is saved or used for some other activity.
Okay, this is a whole other story, and we're not going to deal with it, but in general, what happens to the $8 that gets paid at the ticket counter? How much stays with the exhibitor, and how much goes back to the studio?
Hold on 1 second.
Yeah.
I'll call him right back. On his cell phone? Yeah. The issue is, let me not try to answer that one, because that's a business issue between distribution and exhibition.
Okay.
Okay? I mean...
but this is in addition to or outside of that. In other words, whatever the division of that $8 ticket price is between the exhibitor and the studio...
Yeah. The argument on the part of exhibition is,
right.
You know, obviously, while I'm in the business model of you paying off my system,
right.
Obviously, your money's being used to pay off the system.
Right.
The argument from exhibition side, post payoff of my system is,
right.
Hey, why don't we do something different so I can lower the ticket price? These are all business issues between the two parties, and I just don't even want to go there.
Okay, but in fact, theoretically speaking, once the new equipment is paid off and the studios are saving all this money,
yep.
It could possibly be that ticket prices could go down if that's how it's arranged between the studios and the exhibitors.
Here's the guesses you want to make, right?
Right.
There's probably two options. If there were a change in business as usual today,
right.
If there were a change, there might be two or more options. Here's one option. A ticket price could go down by 50 cents or whatever the number might be. I don't know what
right.
that would be. Okay, that's one option.
Right.
The second option is the revenue split on the ticket would change, could change.
Right.
Do you understand what that means?
Right. Yes. So that the exhibitor or the studio would get a greater or lesser share of the...
Well, a lesser share, right?
A lesser share to the...
let's say it's a $10 ticket.
Right.
Okay, right now there's a specific split for certain days of the showing.
Yes.
It might start where the studio gets 90 cents on the dollar and exhibiting gets 10 cents on the dollar. It may be that it's 85-15.
Right.
As the time goes out, first week, second week, typically this split changes.
Right.
Where the exhibitor gets a little bit more and the studio takes a little bit less.
Okay.
Okay, now, so the second option, if there was going to be such an option, might be that the split changes a little bit more pennies in favor of the exhibitor, giving him a few more of the bucks.
Yeah, okay.
Okay, but again, I'm not in the business world. I don't want to...
Right, or if the exhibitor wanted to bring in more, figured the supply and demand curves being what they are, if he lowered the price a little, get more business.
Again, that's totally between the parties.
Right. Okay.
Yeah, totally between the parties.
Okay, I think we've exhausted the technical aspects of this, and we're into the business ramifications, which, as we both realize, is a different story. Any final comments you want to make? What's the timetable for this?
Well, the problem is that if people want to make a system which is PCI compliant to our specification,
right?
There are some issues in there which require redevelopment of hardware, specifically in the compression decoders and some of the packaging of security devices.
Because, in fact, you've set the specifications, but you haven't figured out in every instance how to meet them. Is that what you're saying?
Well, if I'm a company that could go off and buy a standard high-definition TV MPEG-2 decoder,
right?
All of a sudden now they need a JPEG 2000 decoder
right.
that handles not only HD, but 2K and 4K.
Right.
Well, I'm going to have to go and do a brass board, buy some chips, create a breadboard, do some testing.
Right.
Once I think I've got the testing down and it all works, I'm going to have to take that and repackage it down into that side, that media block. Remember that?
Yes.
Okay, then I'm going to do some more testing.
Right.
I'm going to get some bugs. I want to do some beta testing maybe somewhere. Finally, I'm going to have a productized version of this thing ready to be sold.
Sounds like 2 to 3 years.
Well, the average time for that, if you talk to a number of people that understand what we're up to, and I had lunch with one today who I won't mention,
right.
and he's a system integrator, end-to-end, okay?
Right.
He's saying, you know what, he says, we're looking, he says, from once you told us, once you give us your final spec,
right.
he says, we're looking at 18 months.
Oh, okay.
Okay, now we're hoping our final spec comes out here in the next few days or a couple weeks or whatever, but we're right there close to the end. So, but the average company or the typical company will tell you that really understands this problem is if you want a good productized, reliable system, give us at least 18 months. Now, the guys who want to do something today, first off, they're using MPEG, not JPEG.
Right.
Okay. They're using HD TV, not 2K and 4K.
Right.
Typically. They're using what they already have that's off the shelf, basically.
Right. So, but it'll essentially be a fresh start to your specs, 18 months from the
yeah,
specs
the,
to the.
Yeah. The big issues are the big issues right now is not storing.
Right.
The big issues is not showing something in a 2 or 4K projector. The big issues come with the compression decoders issues, that and security, the digital rights management.
Right.
The absolute definition of how that's got to be mechanized.
But
time-wise, that's the digital rights management is more software.
Right.
Time-wise, the hardware issues circle around the decompressors and the JPEG 2000 because people have JPEG 2000 today, but it's for photos.
Right.
Okay? Very small resolution.
Right.
Nothing at 4K... 12 bits per color channel. I mean,
right.
that's horrendous. And we're talking about decoders that take, you know, a dozen or more chips.
So the critical task here may be in the design of the chips.
The chips are designed. There's a couple companies out there who have JPEG 2000 chips.
Right.
But to get to this size image with this bit depth,
right.
okay, in these bandwidths, requires taking, like I say, a dozen or more of these chips and integrating them into a system, so to speak, that
right.
will decode the 4K image, okay? And so people are going, it's not that it hasn't been done. Sony's
right.
already done it.
Right.
Okay? But just because you've got it on a nice big breadboard, that's fine, but what you've got to do is get it down, you know, tightly packaged inside the media block and very secured. So these become the cumbersome problems, and you want something that you feel you can put in a theater, and it's going to operate reliably.
Who are the companies that are working on this problem?
Oh, God, I couldn't even name them all.
Name a few.
No, Sony's doing a system.
Right.
Gee whiz, let's see, who else has talked? I'm not sure if Technicolor's still in this. They might be.
Right.
I've heard of Avica. There's EVS over in Europe.
Right.
I think a couple of the manufacturers of projectors, like NEC,
right,
are also not only doing the projectors, but the system. I think Kodak was there. Dolby's there. Again,
right,
a pretty good... pretty good cross-section. Another company is GDC, based out of Hong Kong.
Right.
Yeah. So
okay,
a number of companies.
Okay. Say a sentence or two about what this means for the rest of the world. Is Europe doing this? Yeah.
Do me a favor.
Yes.
Call me back in about 5 minutes. I got to hit a restroom.
Okay.
I'm in trouble, man.
I'll call you back in 5 minutes.
Okay, bye.
Bye, thanks.